Following up on considerations of horizontal gene transfer, now we're considering genomes. The product of horizontal gene transfer is change to genomes. That's not the only way that genomes can change, but it certainly is an important way, particularly with regard to the evolution of microorganisms. We're going to be considering genome evolution, particularly from the perspective of horizontal gene transfer, though introducing a couple of other concepts. By and large, a lot of what genome evolution is all about is considered under the heading of molecular evolution, and there actually are courses on molecular evolution, and so molecular evolution per se is not going to be our main interest here. Instead, it's going to be looking at the principles that we've already considered and applying them to genome evolution, and particularly these principles are going to include horizontal gene transfer. So, genomes, and particularly it's the evolution of genomes that we're considering. The thing about genomes is that they're not orderly, necessarily rational or terribly rational entities. Instead, they are what they are, and they're good enough to assure their survival, at least potentially assure their survival into the next generation. But they're not necessarily the most beautiful thing in the world, or at least not the most orderly thing in the world. And the same can be said for genome evolution. And this reminds me of a line from a song that I came upon a number of years back. This is from a band called James, and the line is, "Getting away with it all messed up, that's the living." And if that doesn't describe what biological entities are all about, I'm not sure what does. And that certainly describes what genomes are all about. So our goal here is to understand genome evolution, to understand the evolution particularly of the genomes of microorganisms, and to do so based upon the ideas that we've been considering thus far. And thus, this is not a course nor a chapter necessarily on molecular evolution, but instead it's a consideration of fitting in the concept of genomes into what we've already learned about microbial evolution. So the basics of genome evolution. How do genomes evolve? What does this involve? And this is a quote that I'll read you. So gene duplication is the primary avenue of genome evolution. The gene repertoire of any species can be described as an ensemble of paralogous gene families, that is, products of gene duplication, ranging in size from one to large numbers that amount to a substantial fraction of the genes in the respective genome. Evolution of such an ensemble is naturally represented by a birth and death process, the birth of the gene being duplication and death being gene inactivation and elimination. In addition to gene duplication and loss, evolution of gene families involves true innovation, i.e. appearance of genes new to a given lineage through horizontal gene transfer, emergence of genes from non-coding sequence, and change of pre-existing genes beyond recognition. And what we're going to do is we're going to consider particularly horizontal gene transfer in the evolution of genomes. And from my perspective, there isn't a huge difference between horizontal gene transfer and its potential to create new loci, and gene duplication and its potential to create new loci, except that with horizontal gene transfer, what you create is something truly novel when a new locus is formed, rather than something that is simply truly a duplication of an already existing genetic sequence within an organism. So for organisms subject to substantial amounts of horizontal gene transfer may be particularly important to genome evolution, and that will be our emphasis. So just a reminder of what horizontal gene transfer entails predominantly, particularly in bacteria. It is transformation, where you're picking up naked DNA. Here we're seeing a bacterium that has lysed, or a cell that has lysed, releasing its DNA into the environmental free DNA pool, and then some bacteria, naturally competent ones, are able to take up that DNA into their cells and potentially integrate it into their genomes. There's conjugation, which is the transfer particularly of plasmid DNA, and this is a plasmid-mediated mechanism of horizontal gene transfer. And then there's transduction, which is mediated by bacteriophages, particularly the inadvertent packaging, especially of bacterial DNA, into phage capsids and or phage genomes, and then the phage is able to transfer this DNA to a new host. In addition, you can think about a vapor of transient genes that surrounds a stable set of core genes. And this vapor, which we'll talk about early on in this lecture, basically represents those genes that are horizontally transferred into an organism's genome. So you've got basically genes that are already there. And to a large extent, the genes that are already there are genes that have been passed down from generation to generation via vertical inheritance, the standard transfer of genetic material from parents to offspring. And then there are the various genes that tend to be acquired and lost, acquired and lost, acquired and lost, and that is this vapor of transient genes. And the vapor of transient genes are brought in by mechanisms of horizontal gene transfer, such as these three major mechanisms that one sees in bacteria. This is just another pretty depiction of horizontal gene transfer. So here we have the uptake of naked DNA from the environment. It's actually single-stranded DNA that finds its way into the cytoplasm rather than double-stranded, as sort of looks right here. It is the transfer of genes as mediated by viruses. So this is a bacteriophage that is transferring genes into, again, the cytoplasm of its bacterial host. And then there's conjugation, where you have transfer of plasmid genes that are mediated by the proteins that are produced by what are known as conjugative plasmids. So the vapor of transient genes also can be described as a pangenome, and it also can be described as a supergenome or a species genome. So what we've got here is basically the genome of a bacterium, and it's divided up into three different types of genes. There are the genes that are basically equivalent to those found in all bacteria. So for example, DNA polymerase, I mean, that is an absolutely essential gene to all bacteria. There are the genes that make up the bacterium that are fairly consistent within a species of bacterium, and these nonetheless are distinctive from the equivalent set of genes as found in other species of bacteria, and these are basically the genes that distinguish a species of bacterium from another species of bacterium. They're the genes that give rise to the phenotypic differences that you see between different species types. Now, within species, there often will be differences in the genomes of the individual strains, and often these differences will consist substantially of these accessory genes. Now, the accessory genes are genes that come from a pool that may or may not be limited to the bacterium in bacterial species in question, and these are genes that are not necessarily always needed. They're transiently required, and therefore they're essentially that vapor of transient genes. And these are the genes that are acquired by horizontal gene transfer. These are genes that, rather than recombining homologously into the genome, they're integrated into the genome via various insertion events like illegitimate recombination or prophage insertion. And these genes are what will separate the phenotypes of the different strains making up a given species from each other. And the more distinct the strains are from each other phenotypically, typically the more distinct the strains will be in terms of their accessory genes. And that's particularly the case with E. coli. If you look at a benign commensal strain of E. coli, what you will typically find is a genome that's quite a bit different from a pathogenic strain strain of E. coli. And a lot of the differences between the genomes of the benign and pathogenic strains will be a function of these accessory genes. In particular, quite a number of accessory genes are acquired in the course of the development of pathogenesis. And when we talked about pathogenicity islands briefly, that's what's going on, is you've got a number of accessory genes that have been acquired by a bacterium, and these accessory genes make up this, in this case, approximately 28% of the genome. So they're not the majority of the genome. They're not the genes that define the characteristics of a bacterial species, but they are genes that can be very important in distinguishing one strain of a given species of bacterium from another strain. So this is a bacterium, a Pseudomonas, and basically the core genes are defined by the gold here. So core genes right there. And these core genes you see there are many genes in each of these segments, but they're interspersed by these gaps. And the gaps have genes in them, and that's what's represented here. And in fact, what these gaps represent are the accessory genes, the accessory genome. So in this case, these gold would represent, going backwards, this red portion of this pie chart, and the gaps represent the green portion of the pie chart. And a little bit of the gold portion also consists of this 8%, the core genes, as well. So we can go back to these ideas. So we've got a genome that's made up of these core genes. Among them is the small subunit RNAs, which are so important for distinguishing one bacterium or one eukaryotic cell from another in developing these trees of showing the relationships of all living things. In addition to the core genes, you have this vapor of transient genes. And so this is a relatively small subset of the total number of genes. We can think of stabilizing selection as acting on the core genes. So this is what maintains the core genes as core genes that define a given bacterial species. These are the genes that these species require, and require often enough that they're retained in most of the members of a given species. There's some variance in what core genes are actually present between species. In a given species, not every core gene is going to be present in every single member of the species, which does get to the question of just what exactly is a core gene versus a non-core gene. But nonetheless, these are the genes that within a bacterial species that are more or less under stabilizing selection. That is, the loss of these genes tends to be selected against. And in addition, the gaining of additional core genes tends to be selected against. Many examples of stabilizing selection can be found on the web. Here's a selection of Google images, and here's a particular one which I'll highlight. So what we have here is a distribution of phenotypes within a population. Presumably they represent or they have underlying genotypic differences. With stabilizing selection, what you have is selection around the mean, that is selection around the majority. Presumably the majority individuals are the more fit individuals within this population. That assumes that the population has been inhabiting an environment for quite some time, such that it has become well adapted to that environment. You see the loss of the extremes of this population on this bell curve, and that the consequence of is that the majority population remains the majority. The extreme genotypes that provide extreme phenotypes have a lower fitness than the majority phenotype, and so therefore they're lost from the population. You can also look at this as purifying selection, where what is being purified is, in this case, the majority population, and it's done so at the expense of the frequency of those phenotypes that are found outside of the norm for the population. Now, where all the action is in terms of horizontal gene transfer is in terms of this vapor of transient genes. So it's diversifying selection that tends to select for this vapor of transient genes. Basically, that means that a new gene finds its way into a genome, and it provides some kind of selective benefit. And as a consequence of that selective benefit, you get selection for those individuals that, in fact, are different from what the rest of the population looks like. So the population is diversified in terms of its genetic variation, in that there is a variant on the genetic scheme of this species that as a consequence of the acquisition of some beneficial allele is now increasing in prevalence within the population. Now, you gain this vapor of transient genes via horizontal gene transfer. You also can gain it via duplication, which is not a horizontal gene transfer event necessarily. So you can end up with different genes that come in either via transformation, transduction, conjugation, particularly transduction and conjugation, but you can also duplicate existing genes. And those existing genes can then mutate to give you novel properties. However, as I mentioned earlier, it is primarily the acquisition of new genes via horizontal gene transfer that is the consideration in this lecture. You also have, in addition to the gaining of genes and the selection for those genes, if they happen to be beneficial, you have the potential for loss of genes. And in fact, you have a steady state that emerges where generally the size of a bacterial genome remains more or less constant, but there's this vapor of transient genes that are always coming in, but they're transient genes, which means that they're always being lost as well. They're lost via mutation, which is a loss of function, and they're lost as a consequence of deletions found within the genome of these organisms. The same thing is true for genes that are the product simply of duplication of already existing genes. These two can be lost mutationally and via deletion. When genes are lost mutationally such that they're no longer functional, they're described as pseudogenes within a genome. We can also consider a middle ground between the extremes of core genes on the one hand and this vapor of transient genes on the other hand. And these could be described as orthologously replaceable genes. In this case, these would be core genes by and large, and these core genes would not be eliminated, but instead they would be replaced with a more or less equivalent gene. Now, the more interactions that a gene has, that the product of a gene has with the products of other genes, the more epistatic interactions, likely the less potential there will be for the swapping of a gene out and replacement with an equivalent gene that has come from a different species. And so these kind of lie at the interface or between this vapor of transient genes and core genes, therefore. So up here, perhaps, there will be genes that you really can't replace very easily with equivalent copies from another genome. In the middle here would be genes that you really can't do without, bacterial species can't do without, but nonetheless, these are pretty much replaceable, at least to some degree, from using genes to coming from a different bacterial genome. And then lastly are the vapor of transient genes, which are acquired by and large by insertion events, so illegitimate recombination or instead prophage insertion. So basically you have insertions over here, you really can't swap these guys out or lose them over here, and then in the middle you have genes that are potentially replaceable using as a consequence of homologous recombination. So this is our comparison of B. anthracis and B. cereus again, and if you look on here you can see a bunch of spots or bars in this band right here, and these constitute various prophages or non-phage unique sequences. So these are this vapor of transient genes, or at least they're the transient genes that have found their way into one of these genomes. And you can see that they consist of some combination of prophages and non-prophage insertions into one of these genomes. So these are the accessory genes. And they come from a pool of accessory genes that's much larger than the number of accessory genes that are actually will be found in a given genome. There's lots of different potential accessory genes out there, but a given bacterium is only going to possess a few of those accessory genes, a subset. So this is a representation of, again, similar ideas. What you basically have is an E. coli genome here, and the genome has some number of core genes that's associated with it. And there are also genes that that are not core genes, that are accessory genes. But these accessory genes come from a larger E. coli genome, the pan genome, that does not exist in any one E. coli. But if you sequence enough E. coli species, enough E. coli strains rather, you end up finding a number of accessory genes. And this is what this 10,131 genes represents. But within a given E. coli, the number of accessory genes will be relatively slight. However, you can see that particularly in these E. coli pathogens, they can contain an awful lot of accessory genes relative to their core genes, or the number of core genes. So we can continue along these general lines, thinking about various terms that we can apply to different genes within a bacterial genome. So the pan genome, this is this vapor of transient genes. This is the genes that that basically move in and out of the genomes of bacteria. But what else is there? Well, there's the extended core genes. So these are found genes that are found in nearly all bacterial species. There are distributed genes. These are found in some strains of the species, but not all of them. They're perhaps not quite as transient as the pan genome or the vapor of transient genes. The character genes, these are the core genes that basically define what a species is all about. And these tend to be quite stable within a bacterial genome. These are the genes that are under stabilizing selection. The accessory genes, these are genes that are prophage associated. So they're genes that are brought in by prophages such as morons. There are genes that are unique to a given bacterial strain, and these are clearly products of horizontal gene transfer. We could make the argument that instead that we started out with a bacterial genome that consisted of an enormous number of genes, and that over time we've just had selective loss of different genes in a given lineage, and therefore, as a consequence, these would not be a product of horizontal gene transfer, but instead just a retention within the genomes of genes that had always been there. But that is not the way in modern biology or modern microbiology that one thinks about or typically thinks about the origin of unique genes that are found in genomes. When you see a unique gene in a genome, you usually think, aha, that is a product of horizontal gene transfer. And the more genomes you've looked at and you don't see that unique gene, but you see it in, say, one of the genes you've sequenced, one of the genomes you've sequenced, then you say, aha, this is likely a product of horizontal gene transfer. It's also important to keep in mind when comparing genes and trying to decide whether or not they're unique, and that is that when you're actually doing searches and trying to discover whether or not two genes, in fact, are similar to one another, when you're doing comparisons or comparing a gene sequence to a database, that you're always going to be using a metric that allows you to determine, to some degree arbitrarily decide between whether something is in fact the same gene or a similar gene versus a gene that's not the same or dissimilar. And where you place these cutoff values, therefore, is going to determine whether or not you decide that a given gene is the same as another gene versus not the same as another gene. And so it's important to keep that in mind, that proclamations that a gene, in fact, is unique within a genome can be a little bit dependent upon how you define unique. On the other hand, when you have a gene that is in a position within a genome that is unique, where you simply see a new gene there where you don't see that gene elsewhere in other genomes, that is information, although it's not necessarily information that you have horizontal gene transfer that has occurred, because if that gene is similar to a gene found in another genome in a different location, it could be that the gene is simply moved in terms of its location within a genome. What you have here is a comparison of the genomes from five different strains of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And by and large, these genomes are consistent in terms of what genes are present, but the placement of these genes differs greatly in a number of instances. So for example, these blue streaks here, these blue lines, indicate similar alleles. So basically equivalent genes on these chromosomes, but they're in different locations relative to these genes here. In fact, they're at this end of the genome here, or on the other side of the red genes here, whereas they're over here. And you can see the displacement of the genes by the greater degree to which the these lines are diagonal, or closer to horizontal rather than vertical. And you can see a number of these lines that are way off of the vertical. And this is simply showing genomic rearrangements have occurred within these Pseudomonas strains, such that although they retain the same number of genes, more or less, the genes are in fact are found in different locations. So when you find a gene in a location where it doesn't seem to belong, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily a product of a horizontal gene transfer event. It could be a consequence simply of a genomic rearrangement event, or alternatively, it could be a consequence of a duplication event where the original gene is located somewhere in the genome, and the new gene has been acquired as a consequence of simply a mistake in replication recombination, such that you end up with two copies of what was originally the same gene instead of just one. So it's also possible to classify genes based upon horizontal gene transfer explicitly. And so we have our core genes, and basically these are the genes that we would use to define an organismal or species phylogeny. So these are the genes that we don't expect to be experiencing horizontal gene transfer, or at least not horizontal gene transfer that results in a substantial change in either the sequence of a gene or its location within a genome. Then you have this idea of orthologously replaceable genes. So these are genes that in fact can be character genes. They can be genes that are important in defining a species, but they have a potential to be replaceable via homologous recombination. So these are the orthologously replaceable genes. The genes can stay in the same location. They can have more or less the same sequence, but they actually can be replaced with the gene that came from a different species. And when you're making trees, when you're determining phylogenies based upon these orthologously replaceable genes, you'll end up typically with phylogenies that are different than what one sees in terms of the organismal phylogeny. So there'll be some core phylogeny that'll be fairly consistent from gene to gene of those genes making up the core genome, and then there'll be the orthologously replaceable genes. These are genes that tend to be there in a different species, but the phylogenies that you make using these genes will tend to differ from those of the core genes. And then you have products of illegitimate recombination, or prophages, or plasmids, and these are basically the accessory genes, and they come in basically two categories. So one of them are genes that arrive and are beneficial. Natural selection favors their retention within genomes. And therefore, these genes have the potential to move from genome to genome, and when they arrive in a new genome, they at least have some potential of of remaining in that genome because natural selection favors their presence there. And then you have another set of genes that can be described as hitchhiking genes. These are genes that are not supplying a benefit to a genome. They're simply present in the genome either as a consequence of physical proximity to beneficial genes. In other words, it's difficult to delete these genes without also deleting the beneficial genes. Or these genes tend to arrive during the same horizontal gene transfer events as the beneficial genes. Alternatively, the hitchhiking genes simply can be there because they've arrived within a genome. The genome otherwise has been subject to, the genotype otherwise has been subject to periodic selection. And so the entire genotype has become fixed within an environment, and at least for some transient period of time, these hitchhiking genes remain until, in fact, they're lost from the genome as a consequence of deletion events. So here's a reiteration of classification that's based upon horizontal gene transfer. So this is the likelihood of horizontal gene transfer, as well as the likelihood that we'll recognize something as being horizontally transferred, as well as the potential for the genes to remain within a genome once they've been transferred. So there are, again, our core genes. So these are genes for which horizontal gene transfer is not easily recognized. So these are genes that define organismal phylogenies. These are genes that tend to have gene products that interact with a substantial number of other gene products. So these would be epistatic interactions because they're interactions as seen between genes. You could also describe these genes as being co-adapted genes. These are genes that are not necessarily easy to replace with different versions of the same gene. And so if they are replaced, we have difficulty even telling that they've been replaced, because although really anything can be subject to homologous recombination, it doesn't mean that the products of homologous recombination are going to survive. And the core genes are ones for which only those products of homologous recombination that don't substantially modify the gene sequence actually have some potential to survive within a genome. So then there are genes that are subject to orthologous replacement, and particularly observable orthologous replacement. So core genes are subject or can be subject to orthologous replacement. They can be swapped. They can be subject to homologous recombination. But the core genes do not allow for a great deal of sequence variation as a product of this homologous recombination. Whereas these observably orthologously replaceable genes, these can be subject to homologous recombination, and the products of that homologous recombination, the products of gene swapping, can have sufficient sequence variation relative to the original gene that you can actually tell that a swapping event has occurred. And the result of this is that these genes will tend to lack a correspondence between their phylogeny and that of the organism. So there'll be genes for which, if you determine a phylogeny for these genes, the phylogeny will be pretty much the same for all of these genes, because these genes are not varying as a consequence of horizontal gene transfer, or at least not observable horizontal gene transfer. The genes that are orthologously replaceable in a way that you can actually tell that they've been replaced, on the other hand, will have phylogenies that differ from those of the core genes, as well as differing from each other, because these genes will have a observably different evolutionary history that's a consequence of the organism acquiring new genes from other organisms and then having those genes replacing existing genes via homologous recombination. Now, on a different tack, we have the genes that, in fact, come in and are beneficial. And these beneficial genes, by and large, are not going to be genes that do not change the sequence by much, because if you don't change the sequence by much, there may not be a phenotypic difference, and therefore there may not be a fitness difference. And also, when you've got an allele that has adapted to a given genome, If you replace that allele with one that's not adapted to that genome, chances are it's not going to be a beneficial allele. In fact, it'd probably be a detrimental allele. So these beneficial alleles, these often are the products of insertion events. So it could be a product of illegitimate recombination or prophage insertion. Plasmids aren't in, don't necessarily insert into the chromosome, but it's the same idea. Rather than inserting into the chromosome in order for their genes to stick around inside of a cell over time, instead they've got alternative means by which the genes associated with the plasmid are retained. That is the mechanisms that the plasmid employs in order to keep from being lost from a bacterial cytoplasm. So these are beneficial alleles. They're alleles that arrive by and large via illegitimate recombination, although not exclusively. They tend to be retained within the population as a consequence of natural selection. And then there are the genes that make it into a genome and are retained within that genome over some reasonably long period of time. And these are genes that are there simply because they've hitchhiked along with other genes. Either they've hitchhiked in the course of their acquisition, or they've hitchhiked subsequently after being acquired as a consequence of periodic selection. But they're not actually contributing to the fitness of the organism. They're not increasing the fitness of the organism, contrasting beneficial loci. There's also a fifth category, and that are genes that are acquired and have a detrimental impact on the genome that they're found in. And these genes will tend to be lost from a population as a consequence of natural selection. So perhaps the definitive core genes are the 16S or 18S ribosomal rRNA genes. That can be found in all cellular organisms, either 16S or 18S. These are the small subunit ribosomal RNA genes, and they give rise to a significant portion of the ribosome itself. They're not protein encoding genes, and so they're not constrained in terms of reading frames or what codons that they carry. But they are constrained in terms of their interaction with other proteins and RNAs that do make up these proteins. And as a consequence of that, they tend to evolve at a rate that is sufficiently slow that we are able to use these genes as a universal marker for studying the evolution of the cellular organisms. Thus, we can infer that that distant that that differences in the sequence of these genes map more or less equivalently to distances in terms of evolutionary divergence between the two species that we're comparing and their common ancestor, most recent common ancestor. But nonetheless, these are basically the definitive genes when making organismal phylogenies. There are more organismal phylogenies that have been made with 16S and 18S rRNA gene sequences than really any other method when we're generating a universal tree comparing the three domains. In fact, the definition of the three domains originally came from these distinctions that are seen among these ribosomal rRNA genes. So we've got our core genes. Our core genes define an organismal or species phylogenies. And so you can basically determine a phylogeny, a gene-based phylogeny for a core gene, and that phylogeny should be more or less equivalent to phylogenies that are determined for other core genes associated with the same organisms. The structure of these genes matter. So it's not just that they have a function, it's that they're interacting with other molecules, particularly the products of other core genes within a genome, and that's what makes core genes difficult to replace. It makes core genes difficult to change, and that's because changes in these genes can affect their not just their function, but their ability to interact with other genes, which is a component of their function. And therefore, changes tend to be detrimental. So, trying to swap a core gene with a gene, the equivalent gene from another organism, can be difficult because the core genes are relatively unique within a given genome in terms of how they're interacting with the products of other genes. So these core genes, they generally, these are genes that interact with other gene products. So a great example of genes that interact with other, or the products of genes that interact with other gene products, are the ribosomal RNAs, which interact with other RNAs as well as other ribosomal proteins. And as a consequence, it can be relatively difficult to switch a ribosomal RNA with one that has evolved in a different species. Although not impossible, but generally when you get a swapping like that, even if it's just occurring in the laboratory, you have some fitness costs associated with that swap. Then there are the orthologous replaceable genes. So these genes generally have different evolutionary histories relative to each other and relative to the carrying strain. So the evolutionary history of the carrying strain is what's defined by an organismal phylogeny or species phylogeny. And these will tend to have a different evolutionary history specifically because they have a different evolutionary history. If you are a gene that has been acquired from a different organism, that other organism will have a different evolutionary history from the receiving organism, and therefore its genes will have a different evolutionary history. Now, these orthologously replaceable genes, these are not genes that arrive via insertion events. They arrive as a consequence of homologous recombination. They're replacing genes that are already present within the genome. They have enough sequence difference that you can tell that they have come into the genome in a horizontal gene transfer event, simply because it would take too many mutations over too short a period to result in the same degree of sequence divergence. And as a consequence of these differences in the sequence of these genes relative to the ones they replace, you can identify differences in the evolutionary history between these genes versus the genes that define the organismal phylogenies. In these genes, function tends to be more important than structure. So these are not genes that are the products of which are interacting with a great deal of other gene products within the organism. And as a consequence, there's less coadaptation, there's less coevolution, and therefore these genes are more readily replaced with equivalent versions coming from a different organism. So generally less interaction with other gene products in these orthologously replaceable genes. Then you have your new beneficial loci. So these are associated by and large with illegitimate recombination events or prophages or plasmids. They also can be associated with orthologously replaceable genes. Although generally, like a mutation, anytime you change something, chances are you're going to hurt a process rather than improve upon a process, though occasionally you get improvements. With the illegitimate recombination, you're at least not removing old functions, unless, of course, you have an insertion event that goes directly into a gene and therefore inactivates an existing gene. And because you're not eliminating old functions, but simply supplying new functions, at least you're not going to be removing whatever fitness advantage is associated with having the old function, and therefore the new function can kind of stand on its own. Does it supply a fitness benefit or does it not? These are not essential functions, but they typically can be useful following their selection, and this usefulness is what tends to increase their potential to be retained within genomes. And then there are the hitchhiking genes. So these either are not beneficial upon acquisition, or alternatively, these are genes that once upon a time were beneficial, but they're no longer beneficial, or they're not currently beneficial. These guys not just have a low relative fitness, or a low degree to which they're adding to the beneficial fitness, the overall ability of an organism to compete, but they tend to have no contribution to an organism's survival or reproduction at all. And therefore, they're easily lost. So it's not just that they're not beneficial alleles. They're not necessarily detrimental alleles. They're just alleles that are serving no real purpose. Pseudogenes would be a good example of this. And therefore, if they're lost from the organism, there's nothing lost. So I guess there's some parallels here with these beneficial loci that are lost via insertion events or on plasmids. Nothing's lost as a consequence of their arrival. versus whatever the original gene type with orthologous replaceable genes. And with the hitchhiking genes too, nothing is lost with the loss of these genes because they're simply not contributing to the functioning of the organism in a way that has an impact on the organism's fitness. So we can go back to previous considerations of horizontal gene transfer. You've got some kind of donor organism. This is the organism from which the nucleic acid, the DNA, comes from. You've got some mechanism by which you have the acquisition of the DNA from the donor by the recipient. In the course of DNA leaving the donor and making its way towards the recipient, you've got the potential for loss of that DNA. With the reception of DNA into the recipient, that DNA may be lost, or alternatively, it may be retained, and in order for it to be retained, it has to have some mechanism by which it continues to reproduce in association with the reproduction of its new genome. And this occurs as a consequence of either homologous or illegitimate recombination, so either replacing existing genes, swapping, or inserting new genes, or alternative, the gene can be found on a plasmid and thus is retained as the plasmid is retained. And therefore, you have some kind of product of horizontal gene transfer. And the product of horizontal gene transfer can then be subject to selection. It is also subject to drift. Over relatively long time frames, you're going to see either the extinction of these alleles or their fixation within the populations. Of course, you can have extinction of alleles over short time frames as well, particularly if those alleles don't give rise to a benefit in the an increase in the fitness of the organism that they're now found in. On the other hand, if a benefit is provided by these incoming genes, then you have a higher potential for these genes moving on to fixation within a population. There are yet additional ways of looking at the products of horizontal gene transfer. You can look at these products in terms of what actually has been transferred. These could be portions of genes, these could be individual genes, these could be multiple genes, these could be individual biochemical pathways, metabolic pathways, or these could be multiple metabolic pathways. So we can go through the utility of the reception of various degrees of transfer and look at these in terms of the potential for the recipient organism to benefit from receiving these products of horizontal gene transfer. So first of all, there is if only a portion of a gene is acquired. So genes are entities that have a certain size to them, and it is certainly possible for only part of a gene to be packaged. If a part of a gene is packaged, then there's going to be a question of whether or not that part of the gene, if it happens to homologously recombine with another gene, that it's already found in the recipient genome, whether or not there's going to be intergenic compatibility between the portion from that's the product of horizontal gene transfer and the portion of the gene that was in the genome originally. There is a greater likelihood that there's going to be functionality associated with the acquisition of only a portion of a gene if in fact the portion of the gene represents an individual functional domain within a protein. So if that portion of a gene that is acquired essentially can function sort of on its own within the protein that it's a part of, that is the protein product that portion of the gene is responsible for encoding, then there's a higher likelihood that you're going to have functionality. So there's this potential for swapping around, not just within genomes, but across genomes by horizontal gene transfer, of portions of genes, and particularly if those portions themselves represent individual protein domains or the gene underlying encoding of those individual protein domains. Now keep in mind that it's not that there is any kind of mechanism that makes sure that an individual protein domain is swapped, is removed, and placed in a recipient genome. It's just that the products of horizontal gene transfer are random samplings, both in terms of the size of the segment that is transferred, of DNA that's transferred, and also in terms of what is encoded by that the transferred piece of DNA. And as a consequence, occasionally you will in fact have the transferred DNA corresponding to a functional domain in a protein, if you, or the gene encoding it, if you have horizontal gene, if you have a homologous recombination that results in a fusing together of a gene coming from two different places, then if that, if the new gene is replacing a functional domain, then it's there's a greater likelihood of functionality as a consequence, and therefore the potential for benefits, or at least not detriments. But it's only random. It's entirely stochastic whether or not an incoming piece of DNA is going to be, if it's just a portion of a gene, if it's going to be just a single functional domain that makes up a protein. And the incoming allele, the incoming portion of allele, the incoming fragment of a gene, if it's going to persist, it has to somehow improve upon, or at least not hurt, the functionality of the protein. So it's got to actually, if you want natural selection working towards the retention of this product of horizontal gene transfer, it's got to actually improve upon whatever domain it replaces. And if you think about there being the potential for a coevolution, coadaptation between alleles, between genes within genomes, the level of coadaptation that can occur within a protein clearly has to be at least as high, if not higher. So the potential for these incoming domains or incoming portions of genes to actually be retained within genomes tends not to be terribly high, both because the likelihood of just grabbing a single functional domain is low, and also the likelihood of that functional domain being able to interact with the rest of the protein also tends to be relatively low. But nevertheless, it can occur. If a whole gene is acquired, then it's not intragenic compatibility, but intergenic compatibility, the potential for that gene to be compatible with other genes that are found within the same genome. A functional singly acquired gene, if it does not need to be co-evolved with the other genes that are present within a genome, including in terms of its gene products interacting with other gene products that are present in that genome, then it might have a reasonable likelihood of being retained. Of course, if it's going to be retained with a fairly high likelihood, it still has to improve upon things once acquired, and improving upon the functionality of an organism can be easier if the gene is acquired as an insertion event rather than as a product of homologous recombination. However, just as with portions of genes, what you are actually grabbing and is being transferred is not necessarily the entire gene. So it could be more than one gene, and in that case, you could have by homologous gene transfer, for example, the recombination in of one whole gene, but perhaps only a portion of another gene. It gets very complicated, but the point is that if you somehow pull it off that only a single gene is transferred, then the concern is how well that gene plays with the other genes that are already present within the genome, and if it isn't too incompatible with these other genes, and it's able to interact with these other genes, however this gene needs to interact with the other genes within a genome, then it has some potential of being retained within the genome. If this whole gene is a gene that is functional all by itself, it has some better potential of being retained within the genome by natural selection. Alternatively, if the individual gene represents only a portion of a metabolic pathway and thus effectively is useless, or has a low potential to be useful in the absence of the rest of the metabolic pathway, then when that gene is acquired, such as via illegitimate recombination, its potential to be beneficial to the recipient is relatively low, because in fact it's not making a product that is necessarily going to be useful to the recipient in the absence of the rest of its metabolic pathway. So there's lots of impediments to genes being able to arrive in a genome as a whole gene and then be retained in that genome. It's got to arrive as a whole gene. It's got to integrate as a whole gene. It's got to be able to function as a gene, as only that gene. And it's got to be able to function in a way if interactions are required with other genes and other gene products within the recipient genome. It's got to function in a way that's that is in fact compatible with the functioning of the rest of the genome. And one way to think about this is that is in terms of the control of gene expression, where a gene may bring in its control sequence, and that control sequence may be less than ideal with regard to its new functionality and its new genome, or it might in fact arrive with no gene control sequences, in which case the only way that gene is going to become able to function and therefore contribute to fitness within the organism is if in fact that gene acquires a new control sequence within its new genome. This is something that you would see, for example, with you are what you eat. So a eukaryote can acquire, for example, a bacterial gene or even a portion of a bacterial gene. It can become integrated into the eukaryote's genome, and it's basically useless there until randomly a control sequence for the expression of that gene or gene segment finds its way in the vicinity of that gene. And as a consequence of that, there is expression and therefore some potential of increasing the fitness of the recipient. The pathways that these incoming genes or pieces of DNA, these products of horizontal gene transfer, the steps that they have to go through before they potentially are going to be useful can be rather long. And in fact, the more steps that are required, the less the potential that the horizontal gene transfer product is going to be retained within the genome, because the harder it's going to be for that product to increase the fitness of its recipient, and without serving as a beneficial allele, it doesn't have natural selection on its side towards its retention. So just as with a portion of a gene, the incoming whole genes have to somehow contribute to an improvement in the fitness of the genome itself. If it's a whole metabolic pathway that's acquired, the concern is that the metabolic pathway is not necessarily compatible with the recipient organism. And again, the metabolic pathway, even if it is compatible, even if it's not reducing the fitness of the recipient, it still has to somehow add to the functionality of the recipient if natural selection is going to favor its retention. And then you can have the reception of genomic islands, such as pathogenicity islands. In this case, you have multiple genes and potentially multiple metabolic pathways that are acquired simultaneously. Again, these genomic islands have to not reduce the functionality of the recipient genome. And at the same time, they also, if they're going to be retained as a consequence of natural selection, actually have to be beneficial in some way to these genomes. So horizontal gene transfer, there's lots of potential for the reception of a new allele or a new portion of allele or multiple alleles, but whether or not those alleles are retained in the recipient is often just a roll of the dice. There's a lot of different things that have to go right for an allele before even there is some potential for natural selection to favor its retention. So in order for alleles to be transferred that are parts of metabolic pathways, and for the allele to be useful in the recipient, it usually has to be transferred in association with the rest of the metabolic pathway. And this can occur with reasonably high likelihood if, in fact, the genes that underlie the metabolic pathway are linked together. This is physically linked together. That is close together on a chromosome. So what we see here is a dashed line box, and what that dashed line is representing is the size of the segment that is being taken, the snippet that is being removed from the donor and being transferred into the recipient organism. And here on the left, you're seeing that there is that the size of that snippet is large enough that it can include these three genes, A, B, and C, which together make up a metabolic pathway. Now, if A, B, and C were not as tightly linked together, if they were further apart, then this particular snippet in this case would not necessarily be able to remove all three genes simultaneously. And the result is in the recipient organism, you don't have all three genes, you just have B and C, you don't have A, whereas over here you've got A, B, and C. The result is that you don't have a complete metabolic pathway. You're missing A, and as a consequence, B and C may not be able to contribute to the functionality of the recipient organism. They're simply there without any job to do because their job is dependent upon the presence of this A allele as well. So if transferred blocks are large enough to include all genes on the right, odds of transferring all genes are still greater if the block if you're transferring the ones on the left. So even if this block were that big, say, so that it could include A as well, that would also have the result of increasing the odds that the block would cover all of A, B, and C. And so the potential for a metabolic pathway to be transferred, even if the blocks being transferred are relatively large, is still greater if the genes that make up the metabolic pathway are closely linked together, such that they represent this tight focus of genes that is easily grabbed, rather than a more diffuse focus of genes that's more difficult to grab all at once. So genomic islands and endosymbionts represent really big chunks of DNA. And endosymbionts, however, are more like big plasmid or phages in the sense that they're more self-contained than the genomic islands. The genomic islands basically have to be picked up, presumably in a transduction event, as one unit. And if they're large genomic islands, even if the unit is relatively large, the potential for the chunk of DNA to possess the entire genomic island is not huge because the chunk could, instead of covering the genomic island, could only cover part of it on either side, etc., as you're seeing over here with just these three genes. So in order for genes to be transferred with high likelihood together, they have to be linked together. In order for a metabolic pathway to be functional once it's received, you need all of the genes that are involved. And therefore, selection acting upon metabolic pathways by horizontal gene transfer is for the genes to be linked together. Otherwise, they have the potential to be received within the recipient organism and be non-functional, and therefore not have selection increasing the likelihood of the retention of those genes within the recipient genome.